That ritual that you refer to, Hamatsa, mm-hmm. this is the one in which an initiate goes around and actually, well, not actually, mimics the eating of flesh. And this is an allusion to cannibalism, but more a mythic kind of thing. You know, as I'm reading about this ritual, as I hadn't been familiar with it, I'm familiar with some of the Southern Puget Sound Salish rituals, and I've done some research on that. You're reading about this, and you're thinking that these capitalists who, you know, are destroying lives, I mean, who put ideology or the bottom line above human well-being, they are prime candidates for going through a ritual like this, or any kind of initiation ritual, where they can really become more human. So it's really interesting how this particular ritual comes up through you and through the poem and into consciousness.
Oh, that's another way of reading it. Yes, yes. I was interested in how not only is it a form of socializing the Hamatsa initiate, but the myth behind it, the stories behind it, and there are several different versions, involve overcoming something that is very frightening through the advice of a woman who is rooted to the ground and cannot be moved. That was what intrigued me. She actually turns out to be related to the brothers who overcome the cannibal spirit. But she cannot be taken home because she is already, in some sense, home in her place there. She's the one who knows how to overcome the cannibal spirit.
Maybe we should read that portion of the poem. Would that be a good idea?
Sure.
I believe it's on page 28, as I recall, because I think I was just looking at it last night.
Okay, I'll start halfway down that page. We live by at the mouth of the world, and the ritual, draw strength, is not secret. A woman gives in taking Komenoka, rich within the locked up street, whose heart beats here, taking it all in. None walk away. Who are you? She, your daughter, didn't you know? Initiator. Who is rooted to the floor with a root so deep he cannot shovel it, singing, the Hamatsa mask of the forehead, the Hamatsa mask of the whole world, the pretty mask, and the red cedar bark of the whole world is making you voracious. Oh, little man with dull eyes, with three full glasses at closing time, I take you in. So, yeah, the stories are recorded in Boaz. And since these poems were written, there has been so much activity in Canada around the development of First Nations writers and publishers. It's been wonderful. It's been a huge renaissance, really. And I was very present at the International Book Women's International Book Fair in Montreal when Lee Marichal demanded, really, that white writers move over and make space for Indigenous writers to come up with their much more authentic versions of their society, their histories, their mythologies. And so the whole notion of appropriation was much discussed here. And I was very cautious about including this in the book. And in fact, I sought permission from a Native woman who teaches at U of Vic, a wonderful woman who's done a lot with the history. And she said, well, if Boaz can use this, why can't a poet? Which was very, very confirming for me.
Let's talk about the editing. You mentioned the shte, you know, going and being more aware of the need to have that into the poem, being more direct with that notion. taking out ampersands, shortening lines. Can you talk about editing the poems and then how that relates to your practice in general? When you sit down and you get that first blast, how does the editing process happen for you?
When I sit down and get the first blast, well, I read the whole piece, and there will be little things that just, in a way, it's sort of like, it's an irritation. I don't know what is wrong with it. It's just a sense of irritation with a word or a line break or
a comma.
A comma, yeah. Yeah, exactly. When I was, particularly when I was looking at the old Vancouver poems, I sometimes read passages that I no longer knew how I got from one place to the next. I lost, the thread was so submerged, I'd lost it. And I thought, if I've lost it, no reader's going to get it. So that was part of it. I mean, there are poems in here that have been substantially rewritten, and then there are poems that have been barely touched. Oh, there's a lot to say about this editing process.
I want to hear all about it. Because, I'm very interested in the notion of, I don't want to call it automatic writing, but I think there's something to being true to that first blast of a poem.
I know you are. Yes, I've read what you've written about that online. And that's not how I work, Paul. Mm-hmm. It's not. I always feel that the language has more to show me about how thought moves in it than I myself think. My thought, which has a certain momentum to it or direction that it may want to go in, so there's a degree of willed thinking there, is not by any means a whole of what's happening in writing. And it often gets revised by language itself, in the very moment of composition, it gets revised by what's possible in the language. And that is always an opening proposition. It suggests areas of connection, of energy, that I hadn't conceived of when I first moved into that sentence or that phrase. Mm-hmm. So the same thing happens in editing. It's actually another form of composition, it seems to me, because what you're basically doing in that first instance that I just described is you're hearing the language, or another way of looking at it, to speak of it, is you're reading it. You're reading it for the potential that's there. And editing for me is also a form of reading. It's reading what got missed, what got dropped, what became a dead end, and therefore doesn't need to be in there anymore.
So a whole line, a whole paragraph, a whole stanza comes out, boom, like that?
That's right, right. And there was one stanza I had real trouble with, because it came off to me now as racist, even though when I wrote it, I was trying to convey the exact opposite. Mm. But I didn't know how to do that well enough when I wrote the original poem. Mm. So that became another poem that actually I always think of as a blazer-inspired poem, and that's about the big fire and the notion of how spectacular, how given we are to watching spectacle as if we are just onlookers. We don't have anything to do. We have no responsibility. We have nothing to do with what is actually happening.
Like as if it were television.
That's right. That's right. And even back then, when the CPR pier was burning down, there were such hordes of spectators for the fire that the fire marshal, the chief heading down, had difficulty getting through the crowds. So that seemed to me very indicative of the whole city. And specifically of its ignorance at that point of the racial discriminations that were going on in terms of Chinese houseboys, the history of this city is incredibly racist. It goes right back to the very beginning when Chinese voters, who it's true, were lobbied by the owner of Hastings Mill to vote for him as mayor, still, they were completely discredited as voters. They weren't allowed any vote. I mean, it's appalling, really. I don't want to go into all of the stories that I could tell you, but